You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me out there? We've had a few technical difficulties today, and so what? These things happen, as I'm told, when you're behind the scenes. So first of all, let me announce the sponsor, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, 818-571-1508. He will take care of all of your probate and real estate specialty needs. He's a wonderful human being. I'm sure you'll enjoy him. Shout out to all of those out there who choose love over chaos. We love that. Shout out to, gotta get it right, John Yoon, Donna Parker, and Karina Morales of Hyundai Mission Hills. Great team. Love your vibe and a great awesome. Okay, now welcome back to our set today. Everyone, as many of you know, life is always full of surprises, love, life, rhythm, and sound. So let's talk about the drums and what the drums mean, the origins, why at one time in history, for those of you out there who don't know, I had to find out this myself, that drums were outlawed and considered to be any kind of percussion during slavery, considered to be evil and sending evil messages and those kind of things. So today our guest, we have, he is a gauntlet of peace and an alchemist for change. He has years of experience in percussions. He's probably played every kind of instrument there is. And I would love to have him talk about where he came from and what he's doing with us here now. Dr. Craig Woodson. Hi.
Hey. Hi.
Hey, Dr. Woodson.
Good to see you, ma'am.
You too. Yeah. So let's get into the show since we're a little bit. What is the basic downbeat or syncopation of the drums that was considered to be so evil?
It can talk.
Oh.
It's a primary a tool for communication in Africa, and it's been that way for eons, for thousands of years, probably. No one really knows for sure, but the djembe, some say, goes back to 500, but the Numu, the people who are recognized, as the originators, the blacksmiths, they were the blacksmiths in the Guinea area, Senegal area, and they originated the drum based on women singing. And the singing had to do with all kinds of things. It was social, it was religious, but it had to do with the spirit world a lot. And so when they came over with enslavement, it wasn't recognized right away by enslavers, but little by little they realized that the drum could be used for communication. And so they're it's the famous talking drums. That's why I did my PhD on the Atumpan, which are the main talking drums of the Asante people. And so the talking is a component of the drum, but that's the long answer to your question. They feared that enslaved people could communicate via a communist system that they didn't understand. And they got panicked, and there were hundreds of rebellions. But in fact, only a few, the Stono and the German rebellion, some used drumming for communication, but very few did use drumming.
Wow. So how did you start this journey of learning percussion, the rhythm, the sound, the energy that goes with drums, you know, around that whole drumming? There's a certain vibe and energy that goes with it. How did you get into it?
Right. Well, I was always playing on the table with silverware as a kid. And finally, my parents got wind. You know, they said, well, OK, you're interested in drumming. So they took me to the orchestra. And I loved how the snare drum made a buzz. Mm-hmm. And I just loved the idea of a snare drum. So my beginning was in the regular school orchestra. But fast forward through lessons on the drum set and then playing gigs and teaching drums, I get to UCLA. And there's an African drummer there named Robert Aite from Ghana. And I had never even considered African drumming. It was always Tarzan movies. It was kind of a thumpa-thumpa move, you know, stereotype that it was primitive and there was nothing there. And I realized that I had never really listened to African drumming. So I sat in and then I was hooked. And I couldn't even play the simplest part. African drumming, as my teacher told me, was like your hand. It's like a family. And the thumb and the index finger, all these are the family members, the two fingers in the middle of the parents. So the thumb can touch all the members of the family. So that is the baby controls the family. Whatever the baby wants, the baby gets. So that's like the bell player. It's a repeating pattern, like mommy, mommy, gimme, whatever, right? And so that the it can touch all the parts, which means it controls all the parts. I didn't even know any of this back in the 60s. This is like 64. So then the drum that I fell in love with, if I may show you,
is
one of the main talking drum. I have a bunch of drums here for you. Is this drum, is the squeeze drum, the talking drum. And I couldn't even understand.
And what is it saying?
Well, I can say something. I say, I said, Adawiya Kofi Mahomene Soe.
Which and that is means?
It means Adawiya is a bell player. Mahomene means come to me, let's play. So Adawiya Kofi is the spirit name of this drum. Kofi is the spirit name of this drum. So I'm saying Adawiya, which is the name of the bell player. Kofi, Mahomene. Mahomene Soet, let's play.
Wow.
So that took me apart. And I said,
Adawiya Kofi Mahomene.
Yeah, Adawiya Kofi Mahomene Soet. That's what the master drummer would say, and he would say it on different drums or on that drum. And then bell player, you know, the drummers would turn around. They're being spoken to. They'd turn around and say, come on, we got to go over and play. So it's the drummers to play. All right, you're literally talking to them in the tree language. And the interesting thing is there are hundreds and hundreds of languages in Africa, and the talking drums last out into a certain geographic area. When it gets out to the area where there's a new language group, to pass that language on to the next area, you have to have someone or people that are bilingual. Mm-hmm. And they would take that language and translate it into the next language area. So this is back in the 1800s. They didn't understand how the messages for the soldiers, the British and others that were coming in, they knew that immediately within you know, minutes sometimes. And so the talking drums were able to communicate in the forest. And this is the story that was passed on to enslavers, that people could communicate huge distances with the talking drum. So that's a long answer to your
question. Wow, that's a great answer though. And thank you, because I, other than dancing and moving the drum, you know, I didn't know anything about the drums. It's just you hear them, you move, you know.
Right.
But I want to ask you, because you've worked with children. Have you been out in war zones where you've had to take your teachings and help people deal with trauma while they're in war zones or things like that? Harmful situations emotionally, spiritually, where you've used music of the drums and the sound of the drums to help them heal. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, that is the trips that I made to Iran back in 2010. And I worked with Kurdistan Save the Children with Christine Stevens, music therapist. And we went there for almost 2 weeks each trip. Mm-hmm. And worked with kids who were literally in war zones. And we played a daf. My daf is over there. I can get it if you like. But it's a frame drum. That's a 2,000-year-old frame drum. And I learned how to play something on it so I could communicate a little bit playing the drum, an ancient drum. But it was a process of using drumming to bring people together in kind of drum circles. Get a sense of community and a release from some of the angst and people had lost. We went to Saddam Hussein's headquarters.
What?
Yeah. Which, you know, where he was, he obviously wasn't there anymore, but Saddam Hussein's headquarters that had been turned into a museum, and it showed the various torture rooms and so forth. Which is in Kurdistan. It's in Sulaymaniyah, in Iraq, and it was devastating. It was at nighttime, and they had some red lights on it, obviously to give a dramatic impression of it, because it's a incredible statement about what they went through. But they wanted to show it to us in the reality of the trauma that the young people, and these are young adults, they're in their 20s and 30s, but they had been through it as children. And the Kurdish people were devastated by, they didn't go along with the regime, and so they were devastated. And the Kurdish people go over into Iran, and there's, you know, it's not a geographically only in Iraq, they're across the border. But anyway, it was a powerful statement. The other one is, I was in Honduras and working with kids who were traumatized by the drug war in Tegucigalpa. And they would point to these, we'd be up on the hills, and they'd point to these areas, and they'd say, these are all the drug areas, and and people are shot and so forth. So yeah, I've been to places like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is that where you taught children how to go out and find? I imagine in some situation where it's a war zone or something that is unusually disorganized, with terror filtered in there, is that where you took them out and had them find their own instruments, and where did they have to go?
Right. Well, my background's engineering with my dad. My dad was an engineer, and my mother's a musician. So I had those two things always in my life. And I was always making stuff out of simple materials. And so as I grew up, I realized that this was a connection not only for me and people in this country, but it's a major component of how children are in the world. Is we don't give children in this culture, in this country, a chance to explore some of these things. They'll say, no, that's not music. Just go over there, you know, stop beating with those spoons and stuff. You know, typically, you know, stop playing. Not so much in the Black community, I think, but certainly in the generally people just don't want to have noise around or have something. So I defer to kids. One of the things that kids made in Africa was a little can, and they took rubber from a rubber tree and wrapped it around. Mm-hmm. And I came back, and I wanted to make something with the kids. So I took tape from, you know, just at the hardware store, and I wrapped it around a can. And here's one that I make. This one's it's a half version, but this is one that's got the tape on it. And these are embroidery hoops, you know, sewing. And wow. This is strapping tape. There's nothing on the bottom, but this is a pizza can, you know, at a pizza store. And you can just wrap tape around it. But it's, when I saw kids doing this in other countries, I went to one kid. He had made this. I wish I had it here. It's downstairs. And he had a little can and a stick and some string. And he was making this instrument called a gimbri in Ghana. And I said, wow, where'd you get that? And he said, I made it. Wow. And he said, where can I get one? And he just hands it to me. He said, here. Well, I said, well, no, this is yours. He said, no, just take it. Just like that. And I said, I'll just make another one.
Yeah.
It was just no big deal to him. And it was a gift of wanting to give away his idea, his culture.
His creative.
Be creative, be giving. And I showed interest in it, and I have it, and I cherish it to this day. But it's the idea that kids do this in other cultures when, you know, they don't have, now they have computers and so forth. But back when I was there, back in 79, 80, that computers and technology was not there. And so kids were out in the street. They'd make these little can drums, put them on a board, and take them to the market and sell them.
Yeah.
Really cool stuff.
Make some money.
So I've been impressed always by kids making instruments. So I make hundreds of different instruments and do it workshops, or have done workshops all over the world.
I want to address the drumsticks. How much of a part do the drumsticks play? Do the skin of the drum, how the drum is made? Does all of that come into play when you're learning how to play a drum, or is it just beating on something and then transferring it over to something actually that makes the sound that you beat on?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are basically two types of drummers, stick drummers and hand drummers, and sometimes you play them both. So I learned as a stick drummer, then I had to learn how to play hand drums, But when you play hand drums, you've got your hands on the instrument. You're in touch with it. As you see when I'm playing a stick drum, the stick touches it. Mm-hmm. So drummers like Max Roach and others would actually do both. They would take their hands and play with one hand and one stick. And then they would play, you know, with all kinds of different, they're brushes and they're all mallets, they're all kinds of different sounds that you can get out of a stick. But the stick actually has a, it has lots of other connotations. And, but the hand actually contacts the skin. So you got hands on the skin. And then there are the three basic tones on a drum, a bass, a slap, and a what's called tone. An edge tone. And if you play on a snare drum, you hit the snare drum, that's it. You have to invent different sounds for a snare drum. You drop the stick on, it gets a buzz. You hit the rim and the snare drum, that's a rim shot. You press that drum with one hand, one stick, and the other one, and you get a damp sound. So you get creative. Drummers have over the eons, the decades, have gotten creative of how to get this, the infinite, there's almost infinite number of sounds on a hand drum to do that and transfer it over to a stick drum. That's a great question, but a good drummer has to be able to be both a stick drummer and a hand drummer.
See, I didn't know that. So you're saying that people have gone from maybe sticks to just hands, or from just hands to just sticks. And in your opinion, with doing that, who would you consider to be the best drummer that ever lived?
Well, there's no best. There's no best, but there are lots of fabulous. I mentioned Max Roach. He's one of my favorites. Tony Williams is my age. And so I loved what he does. But, I'm writing a book on this. I mean, I told you this earlier. I'm writing a book on the history of African-American drumming. And so I'm right in the midst of it. So when you say the best drummer, 500 drummers come to mind, you know, of all of the drummers that are out there that are phenomenal drummers. And it's hard to pinpoint it. But so the Atsemewu in Ghana is this long barrel drum. It's played in the Ewe tradition. So big. I have one downstairs. The big ones there. The thunder drum is like 8 feet long, but the typical one, the regular Atsemewu, is the master drum. And you put one stick, other arm, or one in your mouth, and you play it, you play with your hands, or you take one out of your mouth and play it with one stick and one hand. So it goes back and forth and back and forth. People like Lionel Hampton had this great technique of doing it under his arm, and then he'd pull a stick out and, you know, play with his hands, and he would just switch out. It was a show thing.
Wow.
The facility is absolutely amazing when so drummers back in vaudeville and so forth would actually be an act in themselves. They would be a whole show because they had this thing going with their hands all over the place. If you're playing clarinet, you're not able to play piano. You're not able to do that. But a drummer's moving in three dimensions all over. So they're able to be, you know, you think about it, drummers are able to actually do a show while they're playing. So the hands out there in space become a thing. And they now, you know, they do all kinds of lighting and all kinds of stuff. You know, Stomp and some of these performing groups put water on drums, and you see the water flying on.
What?
Stomp.
It doesn't ruin the skin or anything on the drum.
They put water on the drum and they shine lights on it, and then the water splashes off, like, you know, you're jumping in a puddle, and the water flies off while they're playing the drum, but it's lit. But things like that are special effects that they made clear drum shells, and so you can see right through them, but they put lights in. And so anyway, there's a whole show. I'm trying to get the point. There's a whole show component to drummers and drum set players and djembe players and hand drummers and so forth. But, it's a great question.
So all of the different drums, like I'm a Buddhist, so I get to hear taiko drums all the time because they keep cadence. At the temple with taiko drums, because a lot of the people are tone deaf. And so the priest sets a rhythm for the pace so everybody can be on the same, with the same rhythm and tone. Right. And so I want to know, how do all these other drums from the other cultures play into the African drum historical background?
Right. Well, there's an interesting drum that goes with a taiko drum. And that's called the kako. And in fact, it's an hourglass drum. And it's played in the sacred ensembles in Japan. And you squeeze it. But the rhythm is like da, dong, and then there's a big gong. So it's just it was always fascinated me, and it's a signal to the dancers. So the taiko drum, however, is very similar actually to the organization of African drumming. You know, I'm not sure how it played out, but there are the low sounds, the middle sounds, and the high sounds, and the all of these play. I'm trying to think of the name of the drummer I worked with in Indonesia. I'll think of it in a second, but okay. Yeah, ahead. but he made a whole bunch of drums out of tires, and
what?
Yeah, how? Tires and with tape, the same tape that I use. Oh, and he did a performance. So he did a taiko performance. Soji Kameda, that's his name, Soji Kameda, and he worked with a group called Hiroshima.
And, I know Hiroshima.
Yeah, so that's
they're here Soji. In L.A. Yeah, they came out.
Yeah,
of,
that's right, Soji yeah. Kameda. Yes, that's Soji. So he tells the whole story about the taiko and how the taiko came here, and there was an interaction with Kodo, the famous group. I don't know if you know the Kodo group, KODO.
Yes.
Yeah. So they were on an island. They run 25 miles a day. They have to be in such great shape. That's an amazing, amazing drum group. But yeah, that is a great drum, and it's a great example of kind of the organization of low versus high versus, you know, there are these little kids you see on social media. They're like 4 or 5 years old.
And they're getting it.
They're phenomenal at a young age. They're just taking it. But that's a great drum you mentioned. Yeah.
I know. I just know that I love when the women step back from the taiko. They yep. step back, and they're usually little petite women. They go, bam, man, bam. Right. I'm like, oh my God, their arms must be like this.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, doesn't drumming develop your upper body? Because I noticed that most drummers or anybody that uses their arms to do something, their bodies are like, duh. But does it do anything for exercises? Just they're already built and they happen to play drums.
No, you've got to have upper body. You got to have whole body strength because it just carrying the drum around and just walking with it, because the djembe is under your legs, is carried. The atchumpan, not so much, but the whole business of just playing, not only that, but it's your wrists and your hands, and it's the grip that you have when you hold a stick or when you play. So I have my hands and all the upper arms are you know, were a lot better developed, but yes, you do get a lot of upper body strength, but walking, you've got to have the whole body working.
Wow. Yep. That's interesting. So I want to go back to how did the drums, and take your time a little bit because we've got a little bit of time, maybe 5 minutes extra, but how did the drums get from Africa to the United States without people getting murdered, killed, or whatever? How did they get into the country in order for them to then now be like a big deal? What happened?
That's a great question. Again, it was outlawed, and there's one drum that was found in 1735, and it's a famous drum. It's called the Akan, A-K-A-N drum. And it's a small drum. I haven't got mine right here. It's over at my love's house. It's called an apentema. Uh-huh. And it's a small drum that's shaped like a goblet. And they found it in Virginia. And I say they. It was a guy named Clerk from Britain. Mm-hmm. In 1735. And Hans Sloane was over through the islands. He was in Jamaica and so forth. He's grabbing stuff wherever he can find it to start the British Museum. So he grabs this drum and he takes it over to the British Museum, and they set it up thinking that it's a Native American drum. Well, in early part of this 1900s, last century, they realized it's not that. It's an African drum. And they said it probably came over on a ship. But drums typically were not allowed to come over. And where did they come over? In your mind, in your soul, in your spirit. So drumming and drum making is a part of everybody's life there. And you might not do it directly, but you know about it. Mm-hmm. Babatunde Olatunji came here in 1950, right? Fabulous guy. And he played the ngoma. He played this tall drum, mm-hmm. and he played the ashiko, which is a Nigerian another instrument, the ashiko drum that Chief Bey brought, actually Moses Mianesh brought in 1935, 33. Mm-hmm. And so the real African drums were not allowed. And the African drum tradition was outlawed, as I mentioned. And so it was really in the body, and it was in your consciousness, and it was expressed in all kinds of different ways. One way was a drum called the gumbe, which is a box drum. And it's also called a bench drum, but it was just a square, and it's called a siko in the Congo. And it's in Ghana, it's called a tamalin, and it's a square drum. It's really easy to make, mm-hmm. but you put legs on it, and it looks like a bench.
Wow.
So it was hidden in plain sight. So a lot of the drums were played on gourd, you know, the drums and the rhythm was the family, right? It's the family idea. So that all the ideas and the concept of drumming went into everything around you. It went into the field. It went into the way people did the agriculture, you know, in the field and in singing and in the church. And then in 1865, this guy named Kojo Lewis, who was one of the last, now he was one of the survivors of the Clotilda. I don't know if you know the story of the Clotilda.
No, tell it.
Okay, so the Clotilda is a ship that was illegally, was a bet by these two guys. They said in 1859, they could go over and grab 100 Africans and bring them over and sneak them in through New Orleans. And they did, and they brought in this ship, and it was called the Clotilda, and they scuttled the ship, they offloaded everybody. And one of the survivors, this gentleman named Kojo Lewis, the first thing he did when he gained his freedom in 1865 was to make a drum. And I have it in my book, and I have this little quote. He said, finally, in his language, said, finally, I can return to Africa by making a drum. And I'm calling that the beginning of African drumming in this country. But there are drummers that used European instruments, brass instruments and snare drums and all that back in 1812. And they carried the tradition. They were using European rudiments and all that, but they carried the tradition beginning in the War of 1812 because they were hired because others were, you know, free, and they were free Africans, were able to play in these bands and the marching bands. And these marching bands continued all the way,
yes.
all the way through the late 1800s. And then you've got these bands going into this, getting smaller and smaller into venues. And what do you get? Jazz. you get venues. So these marching bands are bringing, so all of the tradition of a military tradition gets shrunken down to a small venue, and people are able to, and then you've got all the New Orleans, the second line, all of that happening.
I know you're talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, it's a long, and it's an amazing story that I've been studying here now for years and trying to write about. But the question you ask is deep, because there's one chapter, and I call it the body drum.
Yeah.
How it went into the body. It went into praise houses. It went into the Black church. It went into all of this. So you look at the way the black place houses were, they had a guy stomping on the ground. The feet couldn't stomp, so they shuffled. They put sand on the ground, got down.
Yeah.
And then the singing and the movement. So that combination was, you got to keep it cool, but it happened. And so this tradition was passed on through, you know, institutions like on the plantation. There were plantation bands mm-hmm. that were, in some places, were allowed. And they did it, of course, minstrels. And then there were black minstrels. So, but the drumming was a feeling. It was something.
Yes.
With an organization. You look at how ragtime is played.
Yes.
And ragtime is played in a way that's similar to African drumming. You've got the left hand doing gung, 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 and the right hand's improvising. So, and then you get to a rhythm section in the 40s. And then you got, you know, Dizzy Gillespie and bebop focusing on the core piano, bass, and drums, and then you got a soloist, and that's exactly the way an African drum ensemble is. So then evolves off into the, you know, the reality of African drumming actually arriving with a national dance ensemble from Guinea in 1959.
Wow. So let's talk. I want to travel back to New Orleans for a minute because that's where my people are from.
Uh-huh.
And I want to travel back to voodoo, hoodoo,
yeah.
and religion in general. Except yeah. for the Black church, I've never really heard drums in a Black church. I've heard the choir, I've heard the piano and the organ, but I've never heard no drums. I have to say I haven't personally. The only first time I heard people playing drums at any kind of ceremonial things was when I became a Buddhist, and I was shocked because it made me feel like I was connected to Africa because they used the drums.
Nice.
So that's what really, a lot of that made me become a Buddhist. I'm like, look, I like what they're doing. You know, they got this kind of thing going. So anyway, but I want to talk about when you talked about the drums being used for the purposes of sending messages and sound. I distinctly remember when I was younger, people almost going into a frenzy, like, you know, like when they do voodoo and hoodoo and they dance in a circle and, you know, and all of that. You know, that's how I grew up.
Yes.
I didn't grow up in a typical Black community. My parents were not drug. I didn't do all of that.
Yeah.
But I did grow up in a Southern-based home.
Yes.
Where you talked about dreams and you talked, like I was saying last week, and you hear my grandmother saying, baby, I dreamed about so-and-so. You know, they would make these things real. And then when people would come to our home for entertainment, my brother would beat on something and he'd be somebody and we'd be the groups and all of that. So we did a lot of entertaining in the homes. Because a lot of people felt unsafe to go out because we were Black.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed.
So how did they replace the sound of the drums? I'm imagining the hand clapping, hip slapping. How did they replace the sound until it became popular, till it could be okay?
Right. Well, again, it was a very gradual process, of course, but it was something that white musicians couldn't do. So white musicians were not able to do it. And that was in the marching bands. That's one of the reasons Black marching bands were so successful, is because they could do it. And they could do second line. They could do the rhythm of a funeral. Now you think about a funeral, and a second line is the celebratory part. So the first line is the loss. And the second line is when you're coming to celebrate the transition to the hereafter. All right.
Right.
But you'd go back. I'm just going to take you back to a second to Africa.
Yeah.
So in Africa, in Ghana, and it's in all the different it's in all different cultures there. Mm-hmm. I'll just blanket say, I don't know, I can't say that for a fact, but I'm
say whatever sure. You want to say. It's
all right. So probably it's something like this. In Ghana, there's a religion called Akom, A-K-O-M.
Okay.
And there's a family that's in charge of Akom. Akom is the ancestor possession. Okay. And so when I was in Ghana, the second week on my second trip, my assistant took me out to a village, and it was the village of the master drummer at our university where I worked. His name was Sarpong. And so we went out to his village. He's playing, everybody's there. And the dancers from our university come out. And these are students at the university who have been studying drumming and dance and the traditions, all different traditions around Ghana. 9 different areas. So we go there and we're sitting in chairs, and my teacher, Kwasi Bedu, said, this is Akom, and he showed me how to play it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting there and I'm bopping. I'm going like, I'm here. I finally made it. And I said, I'm in Akom. I said, I recognized it. They didn't tell me it was Akom. I just knew it when I sat down. I knew the drumming. So the chief priest comes over. The Akom is called Akomfo. Akomfo is the Akom religion person for, right? So he's Akomfo. And he said, you know, come up and dance. And I said, I can't dance, but I can drum. I told this to my assistant, Frank Manson. He said, come over. So I went over and I sat down on the drum. I'm playing one of these parts. You got to know what it is. And it's a cross rhythm. Ding, 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 ding. Right? So it's got a cross in the right exact way. So I play it. I get about that far into it, and everybody goes nuts. And they start pouring Akpateshi, the wine down. They start clapping coins in my phone. And they said, you know, they're saying, in a sense, how the hell did this O'Bruni white guy learn this? Yeah. So they thought I was possessed.
Oh.
And but Frank said, you know, later he said, by one of the lower spirits.
Oh, no, because you're white.
he's messing with me. But the point is that. When you're possessed, you're dressed in white, you're taken away dressed in white, you come back, and you are an ancestor. You are a particular, Now, if you have the spirit of a person who had a cane or had a particular walk, you become that person. All of that tradition came over to Jamaica, to Haiti, all of that. So you see voodoo and all that. It's not exactly the same, but the Orisha tradition from Nigeria and the Lukumi, all of these traditions have similar kinds of spiritual movement. And if you look at someone, you say, ah, that's the Shango, right? That's the Shango spirit talking right there. And so you know immediately, if you're in the culture, you can tell what that spirit is by not only the movements of the person, but you can tell by the drumming that's going with that spirit. So put that all in a big pot and say, how did that come here? It's impossible for it not to come here. It's impossible for it not to come here. It came to all the cultures, and it just spread throughout the traditions in Haiti and in Jamaica and all Jamaica. You know, it's not, the J should be an X,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But you know, Americans were lazy.
Yeah, right.
I'm not lazy, but a lot of people are. They don't want to say that we're Jamaica.
Jamaica, right?
Yeah, Jamaica.
So, right. Anyway, so the like you ask is, how does it get? It's impossible for it not to come here because it's a part of one's being. It's a part of one who you grow. Now, what happens over here, over hundreds, decades and eons, is something that's a whole different conversation of what you asked earlier is, how is it expressed here? And African drummers, African-American drummers say to me, if we took that and we made it ours. And so Leon Mobley, who is my dear
friend.
You know Leon, so I've known him for decades.
I know of him.
Okay.
I know him and I know of him. I'm not his best friend. I don't hang with him, okay. But I know who he is.
So yeah. My book title is American African Drumming, Origins to the Present, the drum an encyclopedic history of the drum in the Black family. So that's the title of it. So it flipped the name because he said American African is how it happened, and that's what he felt. So we have a group of 30 drummers that are helping me, you know, do this. And so there's conversations that I've had, you know, in the process, and we're getting to the point where we're able to kind of come to a consensus of some of these ideas, because not everybody has the same opinion of everything, except, you know, the basics of what happened. And it's pretty interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just say this. The book is based on this one, Black History 365. Mm-hmm. This is a 1,200-page high school textbook. Came out in 2021. Written by Walter Milton and Joel Friedman. It's a tremendous high school textbook. And I was asked to be on a Zoom right after it came out with, I'm a member of ASALA. I was president of the local branch of Association of Study of African American Life and History, Carter Woodson.
Wow.
They asked me to be on the Zoom, and they said, would you review our book and take a look at it? I said, it's African drumming. And they sent me the book. There were three pages. And they said, would you write a supplement? So that's what I'm doing now. The book that I'm writing is a supplement to this book to tell the story. So it's not going to be 100 pages. It's going to be 500 pages. So, and it could be volumes.
What I find odd is that you are of another culture and you know more about our history. See, this is what I try to explain to people. When I started learning about being Black, I grew up in the South. So our teachers cared about us. I grew up in an all-Black community, went to all-Black high school, all-Black. I know who I am. I don't have to do that. So when I got out of high school and went into the military, I sought to mingle with other cultures so I could learn something new, learn something different, and then integrate it into what I already knew as a foundation.
Right.
I want to know how many women are percussionists. I want to know... you personally, please tell people your descendants, your ancestors, and how you came to come into line with this kind of work because of who you are and your background. Tell them
right.
that. And I want to know about the women.
Yeah. Well, the women thing is, Sheila, there are a lot of women drummers, but in Africa up to recently, actually in the past, I'm going to say 15 years, maybe 20 years, they were not allowed. They were just poo-pooed. And The Women of the Calabash is one good example. They weren't allowed to play drums, so they took up the shaker, the shekere. So the Women of the Calabash is an example, but they were from the 90s. And after that, because they would go to these drum rehearsals, they, you know, just sit over there. And they said, no, I don't want to just sit here. I want to play. So they said, okay, well, you can do the calabash. That's cool. But now in Africa, there are women's groups all over. And in this country, there are women's groups all over. There are PhDs. Wow. In African drum, women, African drumming, Jocelyn Pleasant and others that are doing their graduate work in African drumming. So that's changed, and it's changing even more and more. But my background is in that 64 time. I went to Morocco in 1970. I saw drum makers there. I came back through London. I saw drum makers there. I come back and the drum makers in London, one guy was from Nigeria and he was making a fiberglass drum. And I said, okay, this guy can do a fiberglass drum, because we couldn't get drums back in those days, any drum from Africa. This is the drum I made in 1966. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. And it's made out of aluminum lampshades.
Wow.
I painted it brown. So these, I saw a lampshade and I said, that looks like an African drum and, you know, a talking drum. So I put plastic heads on it and it sounds horrible. And I showed it to my professors, but they said, keep working on it. And then I came up with this drum, and that's one that.
Look at the difference. Yeah.
It's fiberglass. It's made out of fiberglass, but it looks like wood. And it's got skinhead. So I tried to be honest to the at least the appearance and the sound. And then I, my professor, I started a little company with my teacher, Kwasi Badu. We went to doing conferences and showing the drum around. And I was the only one doing African drums in 1976 at the national shows. Mm-hmm. And my teacher from Ghana saw it and he said, I want you to come to Ghana and see what I'm doing there on instrument making. So I went there in 1977 for a month. At the end of the trip, he said, I want you to come back and run the project and direct the project called Music Instrument Technology Workshop at the university there in Kumasi. So I did that. I did my PhD on it, wrote on the Atumpan, came back. I saw a picture of Carter G. Woodson on a Father of Black History on a stamp. Mm-hmm. And I knew his name, but I didn't connect his family to my family, Carter, my last name, Woodson. So I go to my dad. I said, who are the Black Woodsons? And he said, well, you've never asked, but look in our big book. I've got it over on the shelf, 3-inch thick book, mm-hmm. on the White Woodsons. And in the first few pages, it says that we started enslaving Africans off the first ship, whether that we're still researching. But somewhere along the line, we started enslaving people from Africa. Off the White Lion is one of the stories. So this was devastating. And I had many African-American friends. I kept my mouth shut. I wasn't telling anybody. But at the same time, I was a member of the Beam Foundation in Los Angeles, Black Experiences Expressed Through Music, under Betty Cox, very famous music educator there. She was a good friend of Mayor Bradley. She was a cultural affairs commissioner.
Tom Bradley,
Tom Bradley. So she was high up in the administration there. So I'm finally sitting with Betty in her front room, and I said, Betty, I got to tell you something. She said, well, that's interesting, because my best friend is Aileen Woodson, and her husband's Edgar Woodson. He's the great-nephew of Carter G. Woodson. You want to meet him? That was the beginning. Okay. So in 85, we met, we stayed in touch, and we had an apology ceremony. And it was the church, their church, Holman United Methodist on Adams and Crenshaw, very famous church, the church of Reverend James Lawson. Okay. He took my hand. We called it Sankofa, that you cannot move forward without remembering the past, the name of that. So we called it Sankofa. We invited the Asante people, because the Asante people were enslavers as well. I asked my professor, I said, why didn't we ever talk about enslavement when we in all our classes and in Ghana? He said, it's hard for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. That's Africans saying that. So we had the meeting. Stayed in touch, and over the years, then in 2023, well, I became a member of ASALA, the Association for Study of African American Life and History, in 2016. Mm-hmm. I played at the Carter Woodson Home African Drumming for the opening in 2017 with my friend Baba David Coleman. Fast forward, so this NPR calls up and they say, we want to do a story on your work.
Oh, wow.
And on your 1998 meeting. So they interviewed people, and it came out February 23. And I got calls from all over the country, Black and White Woodsons, wanting to get involved. So we started forming a group. And by July of that year, we had 30 people. And so we have all these different components of our organ. We don't even have a name for our organ, but we've been together since this last February. Another one. If you just if you Google NPR Woodson,
I will do that.
You do that. NPR Woodson. My website, CraigWoodsonPhD.com. All this story that I'm telling you is on the website.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're gonna go ahead.
That's it. So now we meet regularly. We meet separately. We meet all together. We have different mm-hmm. committees. We have a genealogy committee. We have a history committee. We have all these different groups that we do. And we invite people to come in, non-Woodsons to come in to mm-hmm. learn what we're doing. But it's really about anti-racism. If you say I'm not a racist, then you're probably a racist. But if you're an anti-racist, you're doing something.
You're doing something to help change, right?
To make change, right? So
we're going to have you back. I don't have a lot of time. It's not even a full hour because other shows have to come on. It's enough to get to know the guests. So first of all, thank you so much profusely from the bottom of my heart. I just adore you. And the lucky woman, Amma, lucky girl. He's a great catch.
Apologies. They got a stomach flu.
I know. And tell her we'll talk again. I know I talked to her briefly yesterday, but I want to say, first of all, thank you for coming. And then to the fans out there, the audience, I love you. I love you. I didn't say it last week. It was some other stuff going on with technicalities. Some kind of way. But anyway, I love you for who you are, what you stand for. And I love you for all the things you do behind the scenes that go unrewarded and unnoticed. A lot of that goes on. People don't get credit for what they do. So I'm giving you credit from my heart to yours.
I appreciate you.
Also, I want to thank Sam Hansen, the owner and the great station, LA Talk Radio, that he helms every day, every week. Thank you for being in my life. I so appreciate you. And then to get me, you can look me up on Osiris_Munir_the painter. Just Google my name, Osiris Munir. I'm everywhere, all over the place, everywhere at the same time. Even when I'm asleep, I'm still out there doing my thing. Okay. And so I want to thank you. Without your support of liking, sharing, and subscribing.
Subscribe. Yeah, cool. Beautiful.
I would not be able to be here every week. We need the algorithm. As they say, we need the algorithm to go. So I need you as much as you need me. And I could do it by myself, but it's no fun doing it by yourself. So we like to do things together. So thanks for being here today, Dr. Woodson, for coming out and giving us your time. You are a very, very busy man. And to Amma, I missed her, but I will talk to her. I'm going to call her on the phone, okay? And then I just want to say that don't forget to smile. It works wonders, okay? And I'll see you guys next week. Do you want to say one more thing before we go?
Thank you for your great work. You're a dear. You're so unique and so precious. Thank you so much, my dear.
Thank you. Thank you for recognizing one unique person to another. All right. And so that's our show for this week. We'll see you next week. And don't forget to smile again and be good to yourselves. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.